Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. And what edition is this, Audrey, of our show? I don't know. We have celebrated a few birthdays, though, since our show started years ago. But thank you very much, Audrey. You're the best. And you keep track of all this stuff that we have to do. And we are so pleased about that and thankful and grateful that you've done this for our show. Well, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network, ladies and gentlemen. And this is going to be an interesting night. You know, we've got, have you heard that there's a little bit of discussion about the Federal Bureau of Investigation, also called the FBI, in the last several weeks, the last several months, the last couple, on and on and on about the FBI did this, they didn't do that, they should have done that, they did this, but it wasn't wrong, they did this, it wasn't nothing wrong at all, and on and on and on and on. But tonight we're going to have a great historian, John Fox, and he's going to be delivering a presentation on J. Edgar Hoover, who was the longstanding director of the FBI. He had a 48-year career. And though it started way back in 1924, I think, something like that. Anyway, you'll hear this. We won't be able to hear everything, but we'll, you know, the presentation is on booktv.org, so you'll be able to pick it up there. But it is interesting. Here's a guy that started with a little organization. I think he's going to talk about that, where it was about eight people left. And I had mentioned that maybe even last week, that they were going to do away with this little bureau. And then all of a sudden, the police chiefs in America wanted somebody to collect crime for the various cities and states, then collect and make a report about that. So that turned out to be the Uniform Crime Reports over a number of years, and that saved the FBI. And Hoover kept expanding. I think, what, how many is there now, Audrey? Is it 7,000 FBI agents? Don't quote me on that. It should. But anyway, I wrote a little bit about that in a book called Introduction to Criminal Justice by Robert Bohm and Keith Haley. And I do have a book called Federal Law Enforcement and a chapter on the FBI, and that's a free one that you can actually get on the internet. Anyway, we're going to get rolling here tonight. And if you want to do a radio show yourself and you're just joining us for the first time, that happens once in a while, and people have told me about it, you know that you can join this network, have your own radio show, be broadcasting in a matter of minutes worldwide in audio across the world. Isn't that incredible? I was looking at listening to some old radio shows today, or commentary and radio shows on archive.org. Have you ever done that? Go to archive.org and go to old time radio. Then they'll divide it up into regular news and shows, and the old radio shows going way back, and then also to presentations and speeches and news, breaking news like the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Or have you heard them talk on the radio in 1830 and 1890 and whatever, and sing music and songs? It's all on archive.org. Org. It's one of the most wonderful radio sites that you can ever visit if you have any interest in history or anything else. But it collects every sound, video, picture, whatever that was ever done, and they put it up on the internet for your use, and it doesn't cost a penny. So anyway, take a look at that if you ever have time, archive.org. But we're on the Blog Talk Radio Network now, and again, any person, any organization can have their own show. All right, let's start off here a little bit tonight with some news. There's a lot of news, and some of the stories are so long I'm going to hold them off to next week or even a work later. But let's take a look at some of these news stories. I think you'll enjoy it. Here's one about the Dallas Police Department. They're having trouble finding recruits, and this is, ladies and gentlemen, I know I've presented and taught officers from the Dallas Police Department and taught officers from my university and recommended that they go to the Dallas Police Department, one of the most sophisticated professional in the nation. They're having trouble getting police officers. They pay very well. They're as professional as you can be. I wrote a co-authored a book with Mark Stallow, who was one of my former students and graduate students. And Mark was a crime analyst and headed up the crime analysis section for the Dallas Police Department. But here's some of the problems they're having. They can't get people to join this because these millennials don't, it's a tough sell. They want days off. And then be the chief of police in 6 months. As chief of police Renee Hall. Dallas does have a woman police chief. She does happen to be African American, but they can't find them. So one of the changes they're going to make, and do they recruit nationally? By the way, isn't that something? These people say they can't find cops. Why don't you look beyond your border, beyond your state? I would say not beyond your nation, but they recruit nationally, and they're professional as you can get, and one of the best training programs in the nation, if not the best. But these applicants, these people that they're trying to get, they go around recruiting all over the place. They want a higher pay, and Dallas starts real high. There's $65,000 a year, or something like that, 70. They require a bachelor's degree. They require that for years and years and years. And she's trying to get these younger people. So some of the crazy things they're going to do, they're going to allow them to have certain kinds of tattoos. They have restrictions on different kind of tattoos. And they're thinking about letting them use, ball caps instead of the police hats. Dallas still wears the police hat, like New York City police does, London police, et cetera. But anyway, they're having trouble getting people. Fire rescue people, they'll leave the department by the end of the fiscal year. That's people in the fire department in Dallas. But isn't that incredible? And once you join the police department, you find out what? There isn't any better job in society. I help people. People are gratified. Some of the worst people in the world will thank you for what they did. And one of the people here, his suggestion was these people that, don't know, put them in the cruiser for 4 or 5 days with an experienced officer and see how wonderful that job is. This is why many police officers do not want to be promoted. They have the ability to aspire up through the whole organization and maybe even become chief, but they want to stay on the ground and help people. That's like a good school teacher, a good professor in a university. A lot of them don't want to be vice presidents and provosts and all that business. But anyway, it's something to talk about. And very closely related to that is this idea that social media, if I can find that one, Audrey, can you see that one somewhere? Social media is ruining our society. Can you believe that? Let me see if I can find that. Whoa, where'd that go? Yeah, there it is. Social media destroying our society. Sharmath Palihapitiya, he was a former Facebook executive. I just saw him on television here not too long ago, but he wrote a very long article. He helped and worked with Mark Zuckerberg at Harvard in a dorm room when they created Facebook. And he says, this is blowing our minds. These people can't concentrate on anything. The back recesses of our minds, something bad can happen. It's literally a point where we've now created tools that are ripping apart the social fabric of how society works. And it's all, you've seen people like that, and I know nobody that listens to this show is like that. They can't stop looking at the cell phone. They're walking across red light restrictions in downtowns with massive traffic. They're driving their cars with two cell phones, and they would rather have, we have studies that show that now, confirmed studies, they'd rather talk with somebody on Twitter and their text messaging than they would in person. Can you believe this? And I think we need, he says, we need to do something about that. He says this is going to be something, and he's a former Facebook employee. He's coming out and expressing concern how this has changed the social fabric of our society. So if you want to look that up, he actually made a speech on Verge, V-E-R-G-E. But anyway, you can look it up, and you'll see what's going on about that particular problem. I think it's absolutely insane. We had a nice one here not too long ago. Two nights ago, I think, on I-75, somebody up in Detroit, he got on, having been a cop, I can tell you that happens, he got on the wrong side of Interstate 75 freeway and went head-on into another car and killed the guy. He wasn't killed, but this other guy did that. You say, well, how can somebody get on the wrong side of the freeway? Well, you know, toking a little dope, right, drinking too many beers, whatever. But I'm telling you, so driving now is just, our death rate came down substantially in like the last decade or so. But now we're at a point where, and you know, and I've got this pickup truck fear. I'm sorry, those of you who listen have a pickup truck. But why do these people think they can drive 15, 20 miles an hour over the speed limit? It's just incredible. I'm going to be real quick about this one. We now have another study. 8th, 10th, and 12th graders surveyed. 24% say they've used the drug marijuana in the past year. And now you got states that are lightening up on the load. Some have legalized pot for medical and recreational use. And guess what? Those same people, would you believe that they get behind the driving wheel of an automobile or a pickup truck? And some of them go to work, tanked up from that kind of stuff, and that's going to cost us. It is going to get incredible. But it's increasing. And the more we make this legal, like we don't have enough ways now to get high. Unbelievable. Oh, here's a scary one. Really scary. Our Ohio State Patrol here, this comes out of Clark County, what he's talking about, that our teen deaths, five area teens have killed in car accidents in the last 4 months. That's just in like Clark County around Springfield. But stats show that 59 drivers and 32 passengers aged 16 to 20 across Ohio have died this year in vehicle crashes. And but the overall number of people killed in car crashes in Clark County, Ohio, are up this year. It's just terrible. You go out there and you have to pay attention every second with these people driving around you, in front of you, in back of you, and they blow stop signs. They don't even come out of parking lots at, 25 miles an hour and don't even stop to the street that they're coming on or at the street. So anyway, be careful. It's an awful way to go. This is a terrible case here. This is Middletown, Ohio. The police in Middletown, Ohio are asking for help after a mother of 9 kids died from an overdose in front of the children. She has 9 children, more than one father, and according to Middletown police, officers were called to a residence Wednesday night, that was 2 days ago, to report of an unresponsive female. When the officers got there, they found the mother of 9 children dead from a heroin overdose. According to the officers, 2 men who may have been a father-son duo and were with the woman when she began to overdose, they left the mother to die in front of her 9 kids. Can you believe something like that would go on? And then you've got these kids now, 14, 13, 11, 10, 6, 5, 3, 2, 1 years old. They range from 14 to 1 years old, and now they're without a mother. So, oh my, just incredible. let me look at one more in case we might have time. Yeah, this is the one about shutting down the internet. Have you heard about that? We have now found out and made it popular that people's understanding that. I can find the article for you, that 90% plus of all the stuff that we do on the internet transmits across fiber optic cables laying on the ocean floors. Well, you say, wait a minute, I live in Texas and I just text people in, wherever. Well, guess what? Your signals gets very technical, can be transferred up to some kind of thing and then sent, whatever. They go across these cable lines lying on the ocean floor. And the guy said that you could cut these things down. They're worried about it. Undersea cables conduct nearly 97% of all global communications. And every day, an estimated $10 trillion in financial transfers and vast amounts of data pass through these seabed routes. Satellites, once crucial, but now limit in speed and bandwidth, handling only a tiny percentage of global communications. How many people even know that? Now, you know what's even frightening? These are all capable of being cut. And if you're near the shore or someplace, like out in San Diego or someplace, and the fiber's going up, they say it's as easy as getting in your boat and dropping a heavy boat hanger down 35 or 50 feet or whatever it is, and then take off and grab that cable and pull the thing up and bust the thing. And I've often said this 10, 15 years ago, this is all going to come down someday. It's frightening. And we have people getting off the internet for all kinds of reasons. This is one. A financial investment, all kinds of things, let alone being tired of doing it. But isn't that incredible that 97% of our financial transactions, of all global communications, go through these undersea cables. And, submarines and swimmers with subgear, all that junk, they could get down there and cut it off. And they say now that barely 200 a year alone, an average. Failure along cable rates are rare, about 200 a year, along the estimated 650,000 miles of cables laying in seabeds. Well, that's enough that. But that is something to worry about, isn't it? Okay, let's have a blonde joke for tonight. I have one here I found. Of course, this is a blonde man. We'll see how this one goes. Here it is. This robber comes into a store and he steals a TV and he takes off running out of the store and a blonde runs after him and says, wait, 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 you forgot to get the remote. Now be careful. That was a blonde man. It wasn't a blonde wasn't a blonde moment. All right, here's my green tip for tonight before we go to the show and our presentation by Dr. Fox. Why don't you drive 10 miles per hour, slower? Not only will you be safer, even though the nuts behind you will probably get a little closer on your rear fender, but it saves 50 cents per price of a gallon of gasoline if you drive 10 miles per hour slower from like, well, from 70 down to 60, 60 down to 50. I don't know, I haven't checked that out, but that was a good source on the web that actually said that, so that's a pretty good dream tip. And you know what? You actually, people have told me this, when they start driving slower, they enjoy driving better. Isn't that something? It's not a race. I hate these car ads where they show these cars racing around, going over the wrong side of the road, and up through snow and all kinds of things. I mean, that's a bad thing to be presenting. No, I'm not going to talk about internet neutrality right now. That's a very long subject. So study up on that. Maybe we'll do something about that on the radio show. Okay, give me some time here, and I'm going to set up FBI historian John Fox. He's going to be talking about the career of J. Edgar Hoover, who served as the FBI director for 48 years. And I told you how he kind of saved the organization when they were going to do away with it. But and it talks about how, you know, his image was, you know, really high for a long time, and how the perception of Hoover has changed a little bit into his career. So we'll see what happens here. Give me a chance to get all set up, and we'll take a listen to this. I'm going to start a little farther into it because the presenter at the North Carolina Historic Museum, he takes a lot of time to get going. So we're almost there.
So without any further ado, let me introduce our first speaker for the H-Wally Spy Conference, John Fox, historian for the FBI. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernie, and thank you, sponsors. I really welcome this opportunity to talk to you about the FBI and some of the work it's done. And, of course, what we're going to focus on today is the FBI's leader for almost half of its existence, John Edgar Hoover. Obviously, Hoover's reputation today is mixed. If you look at popular culture, you look at academic works, it's often highly critical. I am going to be taking a slightly more positive tact, but we have to remember, again, that that reputation is mixed, and that will come into our talk. This picture is a scene from the White House, 1955, May. President Eisenhower is pinning the National Security Medal on Hoover. And I'd like to read a little bit from the citation for that medal to you. Eisenhower said, "As director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation for 31 years, he has made an outstanding contribution to the national security of the United States. Exercising exceptional tact, perceptiveness, judgment, and brilliant leadership in a position of great responsibility, he has established the highest ideals of federal law enforcement and has directed them to realization. His tireless efforts have brought to a new height of effectiveness the law enforcement machinery of the United States government. Through his well-grounded and clearly defined concept of investigative procedures, reinforced by his recognized integrity and high personal prestige, he has won international recognition for the federal law enforcement system of the United States." Now, that's a bit in contrast to how he's been recently portrayed. And the disparity between those is important for understanding a lot of things about the United States intelligence community, for understanding the FBI, and for understanding J. Edgar Hoover. So let's unpack it for a second. Christopher Andrew, noted British intelligence historian, has said that Eisenhower was one of the first American presidents to have a true appreciation of intelligence. He obviously had a lot of experience in World War II with SIGINT and COMINT, and of course seeing some of the OSS's operations in Europe and so forth. he saw the wide range of intelligence. And yet here he is congratulating a law enforcement officer. And, of course, today we have those debates back and forth about whether cops and spies mix, whether cops can do intelligence, et cetera. And yet Hoover played throughout his career a key role in the U.S. intelligence community. He, in many ways, was one of its founding fathers. He was there at the beginning. In fact, he was there before the beginning. And so what I'd like to do is take you through some of his career to look at how he built an intelligence agency, a law enforcement agency, and some of the strengths and weaknesses of that approach. And, of course, some of the strengths and weaknesses of his own approach to leadership. A good chunk of the FBI's academic writings kind of bring Hoover and the FBI together. And I'm going to do the same thing here, but, you know, I just want to kind of caveat that as we've got to keep those separate to some extent too. A lot of what happened with the Bureau and its development could have happened with another leader. Might not have. Hoover was incredibly important in that regard. I think we also have to remember, I don't know that there are going to be any dramatic revelations here. Hoover was a bureaucrat. And I'm using that in the best sense of the term here since I do work for the federal government. But Hoover was exceptional in a bureaucratic environment. And that approach of his also says something about the way the FBI has worked over the years. So, who was he? Hoover came into the government in 1917, Department of Justice. He started out as a clerk, very quickly became a special assistant to the Attorney General. He came in 2 months after we had entered World War I. Intelligence is in the air. Of course, World War I is where we start seeing this real flowering of United States intelligence. We go from being kind of scared of spies and thinking that they were a dirty hangover from European excesses to embracing certain aspects of intelligence. In the United States, of course, the Bureau of Investigation, of which Hoover is completely disconnected from at this moment, as well as the Department of Justice, are focusing on national security issues. And counterespionage is one of them. Of course, there are a lot of arguments about just how many spies are there. What is the scope of the problem? Military intelligence was suggesting there could be several thousand operational German agents around the country. The Department of Justice disagreed. The Attorney General at one point wrote a quick note to the U.S. Attorney up in New York and said, you know, there's a lot of this spy fervor going on around here. It would really help to clear up the situation if you could capture a few, box them up, and send them to me in Washington to display. Well, Department of Justice wasn't much for this spy fervor at the time. And, of course, in hindsight, they were right. There really weren't a lot of active German agents in the United States. The Army did capture one trying to cross the border, and it led to all sorts of problems. You know, how do you deal with a foreign agent under U.S. law, even if it's in wartime? And those debates, of course, are with us today. But we're talking Hoover today. So Hoover is working in the Department of Justice, and he really starts to enter the intelligence picture right after the war. After the war, it was chaotic. Millions of people around the world had died of influenza. The economy is on really rocky grounds because of the war and its aftermath. The United States is facing incredible labor struggles. The Soviet Union has just been born. The Russian Revolution happened just as the U.S. is entering the war, right around the same time. And all these things are coming together, and domestic terrorists are starting to attack. 1919, we've got a series of mail bombings across the country, the major business and political leaders. We've got a couple of months later, the terrorists decide to take a more direct tack, trying to put the bombs actually at the residences of those leaders. One of the terrorists blowing himself up, trying to blow up the Attorney General's house. America is scared, and the Department of Justice is asked to do something about it. Hoover is put in charge of something called the General Intelligence Division. or the Radical Division, as it was often called. And his purpose was to gather domestic intelligence about the terrorist threat. And he went to it with great fervor, developing information on potential radicals across the country. And together with Attorney General Palmer, they used this intelligence to try and round up alien anarchists. There were a number of laws, of course, in the day that said that if you were an immigrant and you were an anarchist, you were not allowed in the country. And so they went about trying to round them up. And at first it was done to much applause. Congress wanted something done. The public wanted something done. There was a real demand to act and act quickly. And when the Justice Department did, it exploded in their faces. Now, Hoover at the time is in his young 20s. He does not suffer the consequences because of this. It makes perfectly good sense. The Attorney General was right on top of this whole thing along the way, and Hoover was following commands. But Hoover was still part of the Department of Justice. He didn't leave with Palmer. He stayed in. He was a civil servant. And that has a lot to do with his rise quickly. Hoover came into the government as a nonpartisan. He lived in Washington, D.C. He wasn't a Democrat. He wasn't a Republican. Came in a Democrat administration, stayed through Republican administrations and back and forth. Because he was seen as nonpartisan, he did not fall into the patronage system. He was in the civil service system. And that really helped his career early on because it helped him to avoid some of that political wind that might have taken out someone else. So what happened? The Palmer raids have exploded. America's reconsidering. How do we treat domestic security? How do we treat foreign intelligence threats? And in the 1920s, 1930s, these weren't that serious a concern in many ways. Sure, we had some small code-breaking operations going on, especially aimed at some of the after-war conferences. The FBI still kept track from time to time of some of the various communist factions as information came into them, in part under the various miscellaneous anti-subversive laws that were on the books and so forth. But for the most part, the Bureau was more worried about criminal matters, and this is where Hoover really starts to build the Bureau as an organization. 1924, he becomes the leader of the FBI. The Attorney General is Harlan Fiske Stone. He has just been appointed to clean up the Department of Justice because the remnants of President Harding's administration, his Attorney General Harry Daugherty, the director of the Bureau, former director of the Bureau, William Burns, were all out of the picture at this point. Harding had died. Burns was fired. Daugherty was asked to resign because of political scandals, the big one being that the Secretary of the Interior was taking bribes to lease out oil lands out in Wyoming. So Hoover's brought in as the director, acting director of the Bureau. The guy's 29 years old. Now, at first it seems a little surprising. But of course, if you remember, at that time the Bureau is very small. Its responsibilities are pretty circumscribed. There weren't that many federal laws in those days. Today, of course, our federal criminal code takes up, many shelves in the law library. Back then it was, comic book, maybe a little bigger. Hoover is brought in as a placeholder because he was a civil servant. Attorney General didn't quite know what to do. He wanted to find someone who could lead this detective force because he needed detectives. Hoover had a good reputation. He was seen as a hard worker. He was seen as very intelligent, but he was young. He'd been caught up in some of that Palmer stuff earlier on. These are all things Stone knew. So what he did was he made Hoover acting director while he continued to look for someone else. He gave Hoover a bunch of marching orders. I want you to purge the Bureau of political appointees. I want you to make the training and standards for what the agents do more rigid. I want better control over the individual offices. And when Hoover came in and sent an inspector down to New Orleans, the guy walks into the office at 8 o'clock in the morning when it's supposed to open up, and there's a guy sitting there dictating to a secretary. The guy isn't a federal employee. has no connection to the Bureau, well, one connection to the Bureau. It turns out he is a local politician. He's the father of the special agent in charge down there. Special agent in charge walks in half hour later, smelling like he'd been out all night having fun. That was some of the problems that the Bureau was facing at the time. Of course, this was in the middle of Prohibition, so the guy wasn't supposed to be having that kind of fun at night, especially not as a law enforcement officer. So Hoover really cleans up the place, and he does it with speed and efficiency, and he impresses Stone enough that he makes him director by December of 1924. Now, little did Stone know that Hoover would then serve for another almost 48 years as director. But regardless, 1920s, 1930s, not a big intelligence issue, but the groundwork that Hoover's setting in reforming the Bureau, setting up professional standards here, insisting that the Bureau should be well-organized, that its records, and this, of course, is one of his big one of the big things that he brings to the Bureau, that its records should be vastly improved by especially cross-references, you know, making sure that each individual item of information can be found if you're looking for it through various different means. You know, one of the lessons he picked up in the Library of Congress, not the filing system itself, but just the idea that you could have a card catalog to access all this. Now, he had the best paper database in the world for many, many years. And that creates problems later on when you want to computerize it. But that was after his death, so we don't have to worry about that one. So Hoover is reforming the Bureau. In the 1930s, intelligence starts becoming an issue again. Why? Well, because we have a couple of things going on. We've got the Japanese starting to expand their boundaries in Asia. We have the Germans making noise about wanting a living space and starting to push the political boundaries and pulling the political wires in Europe. And, of course, we have the Soviets. The United States recognizes the Soviet Union very early on in Franklin Roosevelt's administration and provides them a number of platforms with which to start infiltrating the country.
And you had members of Congress, which – J. Edgar Hoover liked to form files about that he could use later for a number of things. I don't know if Dr. Fox will get to that.
So all these things are going on. By the mid-1930s, German and Japanese espionage is starting to come on the radars of the Navy, especially out west, and the Army. And they're starting to wonder, how do we deal with these situations here at home? And they go to the Attorney General. And the Attorney General says, well, we have the FBI. And so the Bureau starts to investigate a number of these things. Of course, the situation in Europe heats up. And as war is approaching, what do we do? Well, this time around, we have a number of leaders in the government who have had some experience with intelligence issues and with wartime threats. All of these folks have been young officers, agents, bureaucrats in the war before. And so they start to talk about how to divide up responsibility. The FBI, the Army, and the Navy all start to get together. Now remember, this is before CIA, many years before. This is even before the OSS. They're starting to divide up responsibility for homeland security, as we might call it today, or domestic security. And Hoover's playing a central role in it, because of the responsibilities of the Bureau to enforce the laws and capture spies. Now, our first spy case goes pretty poorly. Gunther Runrich was not a great spy. He got some blank passport applications. He tried to get the defense plans of the East Coast by calling up and pretending to be an Army official and saying, please bring the plans to me pronto to my hotel. Army didn't think that was quite upright and ended up sending a couple people that arrested Runrich. Eventually, they turned him over to the FBI. And we sent one of our agents, a guy named Leon Turow, to investigate. And Turow did a pretty good job investigating. he was able to identify a number of folks in the spy ring, but he approached it in a very straightforward law enforcement manner. Handed out a bunch of notes saying, you are going to be called before the grand jury pretty soon. And for some reason, none of these folks were in the country when the grand jury actually met. But Turow had some other issues. He actually had started to make discussions with a New York paper to do a series of stories based on the spy case, as the trial is supposed to be coming forward of the three people who were already in custody, so they couldn't quite get out of the country as the others had. So Turow gets fired, actually ends up in military intelligence during the war, and does a credible job. But obviously the Bureau has a lot to learn, and learn it did. By 1940, of course, war is broken out. The Bureau is growing rapidly. You know, if you look at the period between 1934, you know, the heyday of the gangster era, mm-hmm. when the Bureau really becomes known, in 1944, we grew from about...
I'm not offering this as criticism, but since we didn't play the long introduction, we will point out that Dr. Fox, he is the historian with the Federal Bureau of Investigation Office of Public Affairs.
500 agents and support personnel to almost 14,000. So huge growth. Wide explosion of responsibilities across the Bureau. We have the maturation of the FBI lab and its fingerprint collections. We have the FBI being tasked with collecting foreign intelligence in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, South and Central America, Caribbean. Of course, working very closely with British intelligence. 1940, of course, William Stevenson comes over and starts setting up BSC, British Security Coordination. And Hoover is certainly very happy to learn the intelligence ropes from the British as that's happening. Now, we already had our relations with the RCMP. We've been working with them on security matters, cross-border security matters, for a number of years. Stevenson, though, had some issues. You know, there's a lot in the literature about the conflicts between Hoover and Stevenson and the fact that, you know, they didn't get along, especially on things like the running of Dusan Popov, tricycle, British agent who came over here for a time and wasn't that successful as a double agent when he was working with the FBI. But part of the story is not told, and that part is this. Stevenson was, in many ways, a very wild, loose cannon. Stevenson was trying to create a large intelligence apparatus here in the United States. Now, the Brits, of course, were our allies. But as you may have heard said before, there's no such thing as a friendly intelligence service. Each has its own responsibilities. Each has its own interests, and they will not coincide all the time. So the Bureau was very happy to work closely with Stevenson at first, but as they saw him trying to grow his empire, they got leery of it. Of course, on the other side of the pond, they were leery of it as well in many ways. And so you see the FBI developing independent relations with MI5, MI6, rather than always going through Stevenson. Of course, we were butting heads with him because we didn't want lots of unknown foreign agents running around on U.S. soil. And considering that after the war, we found out there were several penetrations in Stevenson's organization, that was understandable. We need to have some control of even the friendly spies over here, even if they're working with us. And Hoover was clear on that. It was one of his strengths. Now, of course, there were also some personality differences. And the other big thing that had gotten Hoover was that Stevenson was, in a sense, trying to play off different parts of the U.S. government against each other. And a big one was William Donovan and his OSS. Now, Donovan and Hoover had history. They had not gotten along back in the 1920s when the two were in justice. Part of it was obviously personality. The two were very different leaders. Part of it was, well, certainly by the war, part of it was responsibility. The OSS had a very different remit than the FBI did. And part of it had to do with Hoover himself. Hoover was a man who had very clear boundaries in mind. If I'm going to do something, I want to do it. I don't want other people having a role in it. So Hoover wanted clear bureaucratic boundaries. The FBI is in charge of collecting intelligence in the Western Hemisphere. I don't want the OSS here. Now, it sounds something like what MacArthur was saying back over in the Pacific Theater as well. So Hoover's not alone here, but Hoover and Donovan had their clashes. And so throughout the war, we have this back and forth. The FBI and the OSS are very different organizations. And both are doing work that is valuable. Both are doing work that is sanctioned by the president and other leaders. In fact, Franklin Roosevelt liked that kind of diversity among his intelligence sources. And so he had the FBI, he had the OSS. He had private spy rings reporting to him. And in some ways that you could see it being effective, but it's such a disorganized hodgepodge that in many ways it was not. And it really needed to be cleaned up by war's end. And that, of course, is one of the things Harry Truman was trying to do in pushing the creation of the Central Intelligence Group and Central Intelligence Agency. So Hoover and Donovan aren't getting along all that well together. But Hoover's getting along with many other leaders. He's especially working effectively with Adolph Burley at State. And so we see the FBI playing this key role in American national security and doing it so very well. Yeah, it took a while for our undercover agents in South and Central America to learn the ropes. You know, they started out sending guys down with little training and few guidelines, and they had their lunch handed to them for a while. But as the program matured after the first year into the second and third, as people started to be better trained, as they started to have better language, as they started to have better covers, et cetera, the program began to churn out some very effective work. So that brings us into the early Cold War and the turn of focus to the Soviets. Of course, during the war, you know, our enemies are the Nazis, the Italians, the Japanese, the Axis powers. The Soviets were our allies, and that was very clear in the approach that we took to intelligence. The FBI was not unaware of Soviet espionage in the United States. We saw the signs of it. What we weren't clear on, and what nobody else was clear on, was the scope of it. And with the end of the war and the turn to focusing on the Soviets, that changed. You know, within months of VJ Day in August 45, we have Igor Gruzenko coming into the RCMP up in Canada and bringing with him a shirt stuffed full of Soviet documents, showing a network of spies working in Canada and the U.S. And not long after that, we have Elizabeth Bentley come in and telling us the story of two spy rings that she was working with, coming down to Washington, D.C., picking up a sewing purse full of microfilm and other documents, bringing it back up to New York, handing it off to her case officer. Bentley, though, was coming in right after Gruzenko. And what happened when Gruzenko came in? Well, the Soviets put all their operations on ice. The Bureau is able to look at Bentley's information and say, well, this person knows this person, that person knows that person, that person had access to this kind of information, but nobody's spying. And so she identifies several dozen people in Soviet intelligence, and nobody gets arrested. Well, we get two people on perjury charges because they lied about knowing Bentley or some other aspect of what Bentley told us. Not the most impressive public display of counterintelligence, but as far as counterintelligence goes, it was the start of something big. Of course, it's right around this time that the NONA, the Army's cryptographic breakthrough into Soviet telegrams sent during World War II, starts to become available to the FBI, and we run with it. So in the late 1940s, Hoover is overseeing this organization that is rapidly maturing as far as intelligence goes. Of course, it's right in the ferment of the creation of the CIA. Now, we should go back to that for a sec because it says something about Hoover's ideas about intelligence as well. Hoover didn't like Donovan's plan. I'm sure part of that was personal pique because he didn't like Donovan, but he also didn't think that the OSS model was a good model for a worldwide intelligence service. And so he offered in return an FBI model based on the SIS. He thought it could be run more cheaply. He thought it could be run much more smoothly. And he thought it could be very effective. He thought that if you separated domestic intelligence from foreign intelligence, that we would have another Pearl Harbor, that there had to be this cross between the two, this interrelationship between the two. And he thought that the FBI would be well served to do that. When the talk was going around about the creation of the Central Intelligence Group, there was this op-ed that went out by the Alsop brothers. Stuart and Joseph Alsop were government officials throughout good part of the New Deal, had worked with Donovan in, well, at least one of them was in the OSS, if not both. And they wrote a very glowing column suggesting that this was the way to go. And you can see Hoover's peak and Hoover's humor poking through here, because the margin note that he wrote on it was, this is the same old A.S.S. No, O.S.S. My mistake. Hoover obviously did not approve. But Harry Truman had very clear ideas. He did not want the FBI enmeshed in foreign intelligence. And given that it would have been too much to take on and it would have destroyed much of the rest of the mission of the Bureau, I think Truman was right. I think Hoover came to see that too, because he was certainly willing to get out of the foreign intelligence business to a large extent if that was what was to be done. If he was going to keep control of South and Central America, then he wanted to keep control of it. If he wasn't going to have control, he wanted to get rid of it all. Now, and this is where some of his peak comes in, the cross or the transition to the CIA taking over those responsibilities did not necessarily go well in all cases. Some of it was personality, some of it was leadership. And the transition, Hoover expected, you know, you guys should be able to hit the ground running and shouldn't have to take up from us. You've told us you don't want us involved. We're getting out. He could have been a little more willing to cooperate there. Coming into the 1950s, the Bureau, in cooperation with the agency, in cooperation especially with the Army Signals Agency, what becomes NSA, in cooperation especially with MI5 and to MI6 to some extent, the RCMP, we had dealt with the communist penetration problem, forcing the Soviets to take a different tack. This is where they start trying to infiltrate more illegal agents, Rudolf Abel or William Fisher, of hollow nickel fame being one of them. But the Soviets have to change the way they're doing things. And that gives the FBI, that gives Hoover, the ability to go more proactively against Soviet intelligence. And you see that happening in the early 1950s. Although in our popular culture, the aftermath of the late 1940s spy scares metastasized to some extent into the McCarthy push to drum Congress out of the government, the Bureau and the rest of the government behind the scenes who actually know what the intelligence says are doing things very differently. The Bureau is starting to focus extensively on Soviet diplomatic establishments around the country to identify Soviet intelligence officers, both overtly and covertly. It's starting to work closely with NSA to gather intelligence that can help to bring out more from Venona. It is starting to recruit agents within the Communist Party and other groups that had ties to the Soviet Union. Remember, in the aftermath of World War II, we saw very clearly that the Communist Party of the United States leadership was intricately entwined in Soviet intelligence operations. And so going after the communists as a way into Soviet intelligence was a legitimate thing. And so we have especially the recruitment of Morris and Jack Childs, two former communists who had fallen out with the party in the late 40s, but were willing to work with the Bureau to go back in. And Morris especially becomes an incredibly valuable agent because he ends up becoming in a sense, the Secretary of State for the Communist Party of the United States. And what that means is when he went over to Moscow or Beijing, when he went to Havana, when he went to Prague, when he went to any of the communist nations, he was seen as the representative of the United States government.
I'm going to cut John Fox off there. Very interesting information about the expansion of the FBI into intelligence work, both foreign and domestic. What he doesn't mention at all is the expansion of the FBI's work in investigating federal crimes and working with local police agencies. And again, that Uniform Crime Report that I mentioned before. But anyway, he does talk about the CIA a little bit and their intelligence work. And if you haven't read the book Legacy of Ashes by Tim Weiner, be sure to take a look at that thing. And Weiner is not complimentary about the CIA. His comment in there was something like, you know, in 50 years of existence, the CIA has not predicted one thing worth knowing. Now, I know they're better than that. I've known a few CIA agents. But anyway, the federal government, what does it do best? You know, Audrey, right? Expand. Now we have President Trump saying things like, maybe we don't want it to expand that much. Anyway, that's the deal with him. And what we're going to do now is ask Vera Lynn to sign us off singing We'll Meet Again, and we hope to see you next week.
We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.